Hi, I'm Cliff Leonard. The next several hours of tapes you will be listening to were originally recorded at one of my distressed property seminars. For acoustical reasons, the material was re-recorded without an audience. Let me identify the 14 different areas of distressed property that will be covered. Tax certificates, tax deed sales and tax foreclosures, sheriff sales, sheriff auctions, bankruptcy sales, IRS sales and seizures, VA or Veteran Administration sales, FHA or Federal Housing Administration sales, SBA or Small Business Administration, REOs or Real Estate Owned Property, GSA or General Services Administration, the Department of Transportation, probate or estate sales, and mortgage foreclosures and trustee sales. You must realize that all the rules and regulations that govern these areas will probably be different from state to state, if not from county to county. Now let's move into our discussion of distressed property. Why should you be interested in distressed property rather than in property that is simply available in the regular marketplace? Well, the main reason I like to buy distressed property is that your opportunity to make an immediate profit when you buy is much greater than when you're dealing in the regular marketplace. This point about making a profit is very important. If you're not buying real estate to make a profit, then what are you buying it for? What is meant by immediate profit is that you can put any property you have purchased on the market for sale and make at least several thousand dollars, if not more, within 30 days after you have purchased it. If your property does not sell within 30 days, then your price is too high. When you begin your real estate investment program, to make sure that you do not get in any trouble with the IRS, you must establish two accounts. One for property that you will buy and resell, and the other for your investment property. Your investment property is for long-term future growth, while a property that is for resale is to make a profit that can be used to live on, to buy other investment property with, or to buy other property for resale. You never want to be caught in a position where you're the only person that can distinguish between property that is bought for resale and property that is your investment property. If you're careless and mix the two types of property, then the IRS can claim that your investment property is actually dealer property. Therefore, all the depreciation that you have claimed and all the long-term gains that you have taken are now considered ordinary income. Once you have been investing in real estate for several years and the IRS says that you have actually been dealing in real estate rather than investing, and you could have a tax bill in the thousands and thousands of dollars. So make sure you always separate your dealer property from your investment property. You should contact an accountant to assist you in how you should establish the two accounts to safeguard against this possibility. You have to make sure you start off on the right foot when it comes to accounting and taxes. An incorrect move in the beginning in either of these areas could prove fatal to your financial future. Just make sure you have two accounts, one for property that you buy for resale and one for your investment properties. When you have learned to buy correctly, you will make your profit when you buy. You will realize it when you sell. If you're not making a profit when you buy a piece of property, or if you don't have the potential in the immediate future for profit, then don't buy it. Don't buy it for tax purposes. Who knows when Uncle Sam will change our current tax laws, as they're now attempting to, and wipe out any tax advantage you might get from buying real estate. Don't buy just for appreciation purposes. You may guess wrong. I want you to buy property so that you can realize that immediate profit if you so desire. People come to me for advice and explain what a great opportunity the purchase of a particular piece of property would be. I always ask them one very important question. If you buy that house today, what will happen tomorrow if you have to sell it. If you buy the house and a problem arises in the immediate future that you had not planned on, how will you dispose of the property? For example, you buy a $50,000 house today using a lot of the creative and fancy financing techniques that you have learned from your books or seminars that you attended, and now for some reason you need to sell. What is going to happen? Will you be able to get your money back, or will you have to pay someone to take it off your hands? Don't think this can't happen. Just the other day, one of the local Wheeler dealers called in reference to one of my newspaper ads. He had several houses that he was trying to unload. Boy, what a mess he had created. He had overfinanced the property and now was having a hard time making his mortgage payments. It's funny how some people can borrow money, then forget there has to be a source of income to make those monthly mortgage payments. He was attempting to find an individual to give him a down payment and assume the mortgages. More than likely, he probably found someone. I wouldn't touch those properties. I heard later he had to pay someone to take a couple of them off his hands. Several weeks later, I heard that he may have to file bankruptcy to clean up the problems he built by using all those creative financing techniques he had learned. Now don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with creative financing techniques. But what you must understand, there are several things that could go wrong. One, he could have learned incorrect information. He could have learned correct information, then applied it incorrectly. Or there's always a chance that he did both of those. He is your typical Wheeler dealer that was attempting to make his fortune overnight. This fellow was attempting to pyramid his way to a fortune. The only problem was that he never realized that he had learned incorrectly how to pyramid. You have seen all those pictures with the pyramids that are turned upside down, with the millions of dollars on the top, and with those millions being supported by a small point. How ridiculous. All the pyramids that I have seen start out with a large base or foundation and then go to a point. So build a strong foundation, then work your way to the top. This foundation should start with education, education, education. No one beats an individual with knowledge except the individual that has the knowledge then applies it. What I'm trying to say is don't be a seminar junkie. That's an individual that attends all the seminars, reads all the books, buys all the tape programs, and can tell you everything there is to know about real estate, but does not own a single piece of property. Be a doer. Once you have acquired the knowledge, then go apply it. Don't hold back because you might make a mistake. The individual that invests in real estate that has never made a mistake is an individual that has never attended a real estate closing. Don't get the wrong idea when I make fun about individuals that attend all the seminars. I'm making fun of the ones that go to all the seminars but never do anything. Don't think by attending a few seminars or reading a few books your education is over. Hardly. It's really just beginning. The principles of structuring real estate transactions are changing constantly. Once you get started, you have to continue an ongoing educational program, just like in any profession or investment program. Back to our Wheeler dealer. To ensure that you never get caught in the same predicament, structure the purchase of the property you're buying so that you can get out of it quickly if necessary. You should purchase the property at least 10% below market or with soft or easy terms. Of course, the greater cash discount, the less you have to worry about terms. If you're able to purchase a property at 50% of its value and the owner wants all cash, then you should find the cash as soon as possible before someone else finds the deal. Once you have either purchased the property below market or with soft terms, you can get out of the deal without losing anything. One thing you have to do is make sure you're really buying the property below market. When I say soft terms, I mean terms that the property can support. In other words, the property must be able to support the terms you agree upon. For example, you could buy a $50,000 house for $2,000 or $3,000 down with a mortgage payment that is less than the monthly rent you would charge for the property. That way, you would not have to come out of pocket each month to pay for your investment. You know, there may be one of you out there right now saying, those kinds of deals don't exist. And you're right, they don't exist. You have to create them by making offers. Now let's go back to my original point of being able to get out of property if necessary. I know you would like to make a profit on each deal, and so do I. But just in case a miscalculation was made or some other problem arises, make sure you structure your deal so that the worst thing that could happen to you would be that you break even. You don't want to buy a piece of property and have to pay someone to take it off your hands. I've done that before, but thank goodness I haven't made a practice of it. You need to learn property values so you'll be able to determine rather quickly whether there's a profit in the property you're considering. You make your profit when you buy, and you get it when you sell. As soon as you buy it, the profit is there when you have purchased it correctly. The capability of being able to make an immediate profit is what initially got me interested in purchasing distressed property. 9 out of 10 times, if not more, your profit is there when you buy a distressed property. Someone else has made a mistake, and you're coming in and cleaning up the mess. And frequently, you will be paid handsomely for resolving the problem. Unfortunately, some individuals will look at investors that buy distressed property as if they had horns. They believe these individuals that acquire distressed property are terrible creatures. Most of these do-gooders believe that individuals should not take advantage of these poor, innocent victims that are in foreclosure. I have just one question I always ask these bleeding hearts, and that is, are they going to run out and give this individual the $5,000 or $10,000 necessary to bring their house payments current, knowing they will more than likely never be repaid? That shuts them up very quickly, because I'm sure you know what the answer to that question will be. Over the years, I have seen individuals that are in foreclosure borrow the necessary funds to bring their payments current, only to be right back in foreclosure within 5 to 6 months. After borrowing the necessary money, they then have the burden of not only paying off their original mortgage, but of also paying off the new mortgage. Typically, the individual that is in financial distress has no money, and if they do get any money, they will lose that because they do not have the skill necessary to manage their finances properly. It has nothing to do with an intelligence. It's just their inability to handle money. And often these individuals, for some reason, do not have the capability to make timely decisions. The next argument these bleeding hearts use is that you are making your living off the misery of other people. And they are right. But they fail to realize one very important thing, and that is, I did not create that misery. I'm just like a doctor, a lawyer, or a social worker. These professionals frequently make their living off the misery of others. Just as I did not create the misery the individual in foreclosure is in, neither did they create the misery their clients or patients are in. But I'll bet you they get paid, and so will I. You have to have a fairly thick layer of skin when you start dealing in distressed property. You're going to see some real sad and unusual situations, and if you let yourself be drawn into others' misery, then you're going to lose your shirt. You just have to say, I didn't cause this problem. I had nothing to do with it. They are the ones that made a mistake, and a mistake was made. Either the lending institution or the person that borrowed the money made a serious mistake. In their attempt to make their quota for the month, the lending officer may have overlooked some important aspect of the borrower. Or maybe the borrower accidentally left off some of the loans they owed. By the way, that little accident of forgetting to name all your creditors could land both civil and criminal charges against the borrower. If you start feeling sorry for someone because they are losing their house, the word house here is in quotes, you're not going to be able to make it in the foreclosure market. The reason I said their house was in quotes is because they are not losing their house. Who does the house really belong to? If the payments are not made, then it really belongs to the bank or lending institution. The owner has some rights to the property, but those rights are lost when they fail to make all the mortgage payments. If the mortgage payments are made, if the insurance premium is paid, if the property taxes are current, and if the property is maintained in a manner acceptable to the mortgage company, then the house belongs to the owner. Now think about that for a second. Who put up the most money and therefore has the most to lose? You're right, the lending institution. If it weren't for them, the owner would never be able to buy the house in the first place. Therefore, the mortgage company should be in a position that allows them to protect their investment. In actuality, when you analyze it closely, the quote owner really does not own the house. They're actually just kind of renting it. When they get through renting it at the end of 30 years, then it's theirs. But until that time, you had better believe it belongs to the lending institution. Even after the property is free and clear, there are various assessment and property taxes that have to be paid, or the property can be taken away then. Each time a property is kept from being sold at the courthouse steps, then you, the purchaser, are providing a service for the mortgage company, yourself, and the owner. Once the mortgage is prevented from being foreclosed, the lending institution again makes a profit by collecting the monthly payments. The owner keeps a blemish off his credit record, and you, the new owner, makes a profit. You know, the rightful owner of real estate should be the person that is capable of keeping all the mortgage payments, insurance, and taxes current. And if you work at it, that could be you. Most, if not all, of our discussion will be about single-family houses. In 1978, I had the good fortune to attend Jack Miller and John Schaub's real estate investment class. It was there, and while attending Jimmy Napier's class a few weeks later, that I was convinced I should purchase nothing but single-family houses. At the end of the workbook, you will find an address where you can write for additional information on Jack's, John's, and Jimmy's seminar. I highly recommend all three of these classes. You know, it's a funny thing about us humans, but even though three highly qualified professionals advised me not to buy apartments, I did it anyway. Well, after doing so, I became an even stronger believer of single-family houses. A 1 5-unit apartment I owned has caused me more problems in 2-month period than 30 houses has caused me in a year. There's just a different type person that lives in an apartment than one that lives in a house. The apartment renter expects more and often demands more. If I were you, I would look for single-family houses and forget all about apartments. Single-family houses frequently have a higher appreciation rate, and their appreciation is usually more consistent over the long run. When you go to sell a house, there will always be more buyers for your house than the apartment building you may own. Everybody understands a single-family house. You also know that it should sell for approximately the same price the house next door sold for. There's nothing complicated about a single-family house. While it may take you a week just to figure out how much an apartment complex is worth, it's rather difficult to compare a 140-unit complex with a 105-unit complex. On the other hand, most 3-bedroom, 2-bath houses in the same neighborhood will be worth about the same thing. Everyone knows how to finance a single-family house. You and the owner sit down and strike a deal, or you simply go to a mortgage broker and take out a loan. While the apartment purchase will have to be reviewed by the directors, the CPAs, and the attorneys for both sides will have to okay the deal. When you purchase an apartment, you will be in the business of managing an apartment complex. When you purchase single-family houses, you manage people and they manage your houses. You also lose more of your privacy when you purchase apartments. If you own a 20-unit apartment complex, all your tenants know that you own the building, and worst of all know each other. On the other hand, you could own 20 houses or more, and more than likely, none of the tenants would know each other or that you own 19 other houses. This may not sound important until you start to refurbish one of your apartment units or until they all think the rent's too high. What in the world would you do if for some reason the tenants in this apartment complex started paying slow or simply stopped paying because of a grievance they had against you? This would never happen if you owned 20 single-family houses. None of your tenants should ever know that you own other rental property. This can be accomplished if you purchase single-family houses. Go to one of your apartment units and put up a ceiling fan, and the next day you will have 19 very unhappy tenants waiting for their ceiling fans. That will never happen with 20 single-family houses. One way, you either have to put up 19 more fans or make up a lie and say the tenant paid for it. Either way, you're asking for trouble. It's just a big mess. I'm giving you fair warning. Stay away from apartments unless you want headaches.
This is the end of Side A. Please turn over the tape now for Side B.